morning is Jones against Harris Associates. Mr. Young.
Good morning. May it please the court. I represent the plaintiffs, Jerry and Mary Jones and Arlene Weinerman. I want to say at the outset that we do not believe that the role of the court under the Investment Company Act of 1940 is to be a rate maker for the advisory fees charged to mutual funds. We do think that the court must police the process by which those fees are set and must evaluate the ultimate fairness of the fee by comparing it to baselines established by arm's-length bargaining in a competitive market. Plaintiffs move for summary judgment based on breaches of the structural safeguards that the statute builds into the fee negotiation process. The issue on appeal here is the purely legal question of whether under 36B the scope of judicial review includes violations of those structural safeguards of board independence and disclosures to the SEC. We believe that it does. With respect to Harris's motion for summary judgment, which is also before the court, the question shifts to the amount of the fees themselves. And here the central question concerns what proxies the court should use in evaluating the fairness of the fee rather than set the fee itself. We say that the most important comparison is to the fees that Harris charges its other clients, its separate accounts, institutional investors, and the like. I'm going to take the two motions in order, and then if I have time at the end, I'll talk about the issue of the damages period. On the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, most litigation under Section 36B focuses on the pure amount of the fee, but the statute never says excessive fee. The statute says breach of fiduciary duty. Our argument is that a breach of fiduciary duty can occur through a purely excessive fee and amount, but it can also occur if the advisor undermines the structural safeguards that are built into the statute to protect the fund. The breach here is twofold. First, one disinterested board member, the chairman of the board, was in fact interested. And second, several other board members had conflicts which they failed to disclose to the SEC. To be more specific, Victor Morgenstern, who had been the chairman of Harris's general partner, became a disinterested director at the time when he was still receiving deferred compensation from Harris. His compensation was, in effect, a function of Harris's performance. We argue that this makes him an interested director rather than a disinterested one. And then second, for disinterested.
What does this have to do with fees as opposed to whether the fund as a whole had a sufficient percentage of independent directors?
What it has to do with fees is that the role of the board, virtually the sole role of the board, is to police the compensation of the advisor from the fund. And so Morgenstern's key role
is to run the fund, to decide what kind of fund it will be, to make all the extant decisions, of course, including the decision of hiring an advisor.
But we
your answer is like saying the sole role of the board of Exxon Corporation is to set the fee of the chief executive.
Well, in the mutual fund industry, though, the advisor creates the fund, and the primary role of the board of directors, we would argue, is to approve the fee that the advisor sets. We don't see a lot of evidence that the board is involved in other substantive decisions about the way that the fund should go. And to the extent that they are, those are not actionable under Section 36B. Section 36B focuses on the acceptance of compensation by the advisor. And our argument is that there are certain structural safeguards built into that process, primarily for the purpose of trying to make sure that the board can police fees so that the courts don't have to on the back end.
Are you arguing that the fund did not have a sufficient number of independent directors as by your conception of independence?
The fund had, even if you take out the votes of Morgenstern, there would have been sufficient directors to approve the fee that were disinterested. That we are willing to concede. But we argue that the importance of the process is to be a deliberative one. And the participation in that process under false pretenses is damaging.
Well, false pretenses. Are you arguing that any part of the compensation structure was disguised?
That Morgenstern's compensation structure or the compensation structure to the
advisors, Harris Associates' compensation structure?
We do argue that several aspects of those were effectively disguised by the way that they were presented to the board. Those would be arguments under the Gartenberg factors on Harris's motion for summary judgment, which I'm happy to talk about if you want to move to that. We do believe that if the chairman of the board, the most influential person under the board, is interested when he is supposed to be disinterested, that's like having a tainted juror. It would be structural error and paints the deliberation, even if you ran the vote again without Morgan Stern's participation, it might come out the same way. We also argue that failures to disclose should not be harmless because they interfere with the role of the SEC in policing the process.
That may be a question that I have here, that the fees obviously are hefty, staggering. But where's the evidence that these are so out of line with other funds or other investment advisors would charge, or apparently very well-performing funds like these?
Your Honor, I think you put your finger on the heart of the issue on Harris's motion for summary judgment going to the excessiveness of the fees. And the question is whether the relevant comparison ought to be to the fees that were charged by other mutual funds or to other mutual funds by their advisors, which we would argue are not set in a competitive market either. We would argue that the proper comparison is to the fees charged by Harris to its other clients. Harris does have to compete for the business of its separate accounts.
Well, lawyers charge different fees to different clients.
That's true to a certain extent, and to the extent that these different fees can be justified by different services performed, then I think that would be entirely appropriate.
How about the success, though?
The success, I don't think that's what the statute is about, right? The statute was not enacted at a time when mutual funds were performing poorly and Congress wanted to build in safeguards to make them perform better.
Your view is that whether they make a return of 20-some percent or a negative doesn't make any difference?
We think that it doesn't make any difference for a couple of reasons. One is that the statute is focused on...
I'd rather hire somebody produced a 22% return rather than somebody who produced negative.
Absolutely. If you think that the returns are purely a matter of skill rather than fortuity, the empirical research, I think, suggests that it is at least some of both. We would resist the notion, though, that the Section 36B litigation should become a referendum on the fund's performance. Because the converse of the position that it should be judged on performance is that bad performance ought to be a basis for liability. And in fact, the Oakmark funds have not performed well in more recent years. That evidence is in the record. Should they be subject to lawsuits now since they're not performing so well? We argue that the statute is directed at the fairness of the sharing of success and the sharing of bad performance between the advisor and the fund. The other thing I would say about that is that the best way to assess what the performance is worth is to look at what people are willing to pay for it in a competitive market. So when the separate accounts come to Harris and say, here's what we'll pay you for your services, they are making a judgment about Harris's performance in the past. That's why they're there. And here's what they're willing to pay for it. But the charges to the funds are so far out of line with that number, which is the only number set in a competitive market, that we think that is the appropriate benchmark for evaluating the fees. Now their argument will be...
I'm now lost. As you said at the outset, there's absolutely nothing in Section 36 about level of fees. It only says fiduciary duties. And my understanding of the norm is that a fiduciary has to be completely candid with somebody he deals with, but ex ante can negotiate any fee he wants. A lawyer can negotiate as a fiduciary of his clients, to be sure, can't lie to them, can't cheat them, right? But can negotiate any fee, however high the client is willing to pay. Why isn't that what the fiduciary duty means?
Your Honor, I would say a couple things. One is that to the extent that being candid is a key element of fiduciary duty, that would support our contention that the disclosure obligations, for instance, are actionable under Section 36B as a breach of fiduciary duty.
The problem is that you haven't sued Morgan Stern. You've sued Harris.
Right.
If Morgan Stern hasn't been candid, that's Morgan Stern's problem. It's not Harris's problem. So let's come back to the question why this statute would authorize any review of the level of fees as opposed to the fiduciary's normal obligation of candor. Right? You don't have to think about lawyers. Think about compensated trustees. If you negotiate with J.P. Morgan Chase about being an executor for someone's estate, it will certainly be a fiduciary, but it can charge whatever fee the market will bear.
First, Your Honor, I would resist your characterization of the scope of the fiduciary duty, because the way that the statute is structured, it says Harris has a fiduciary duty with respect to the compensation. It has a fiduciary duty not to accept a fee which has been negotiated in violation of the statute. That is why Harris is the correct defendant. Congress pinned that duty on the advisor because it thought the advisor was the actor in the picture most likely to dominate the board. But I'll answer your question about why you think this would go to the fiduciary duty would extend to the level of the fee. The first thing to say there is that that is how a lot of courts have understood it. Most of the litigation under this statute is about the level of the fee. But I think the reason is that Congress knew that the relationship between the advisor and the fund is fraught with conflict, that that is not an arm's length negotiation, and so that the level that it added judicial review as a backstop for the level of the fee. We think that the single most important aspect there is to,
if you look in the law, if you look at the ALI's restatement, which covers a lot of fiduciary relations, are there any other circumstances where a fiduciary relation is thought to place to allow judicial review of the level of fees? A university president is thought to be a fiduciary, but negotiates his compensation with the board, and whatever is approved by the board is the university president's compensation. There's no judicial review of that.
The university president does not create the university, right? The university selects the president from a number of candidates and can fire them if they...
Don't be so confident. Universities are created often by their first presidents.
Well, the problem is that it is, as a practical matter, impossible to dismiss the advisor to the fund. And so Congress, I think, knew that this would not be an arm's length transaction. And in that sense, it is appropriate to impose a duty not to take advantage.
Could you answer my question? Maybe the answer is
No, the answer is no. I'm not aware
is
of...
that there are none, or you just haven't done the research?
I haven't done the research, Your Honor. There are, on Harris's motion for summary judgment, it is important to remember that the judge granted summary judgment against us on that. We must prevail if there are any disputed issues of material fact. The most important disputed issue of material fact is whether Harris provided comparable services to its separate accounts, because that is their answer to our contention that that is what the fee should be pegged to. And what the district court did was to say that that is just an imponderable question, that at some very general level, the services provided to the separate accounts are different from the services provided to the funds. The problem is that that question can be unpacked. You can distinguish between administrative services, which are different but are separately contracted for, and advisory services, which are largely the same. Harris has provided, through discovery, numbers about the amount of time that their employees spend on each sort of account. We need to have salary information in the record. It is possible to allocate costs and therefore evaluate the propriety of the differences in the fee. That is a disputed question of material fact. We should have a trial about it.
Wait, I'm now completely off. When you say evaluate costs, that brings to mind, of course, rate regulation in natural monopoly industries, and that's provided for quite expressly by statute. But you're not arguing that this is a natural monopoly industry, are you?
No, what we're arguing is that there is a non-competitive...
There are too many funds to make that argument.
It is like a natural monopoly in that the relationship between the advisor and the fund is not an arm's length, and there is no market bargaining in that relationship. So we think the best way to evaluate the fairness of the fee is not for you to set the fee itself, but to look at what people who do negotiate in a competitive market at arm's length are paying for similar services. Their argument is you can't break out whether the services are similar, but our answer to that is that there is evidence in the record that would allow you to do that. There are also disputed issues under each of the other Gartenberg factors, which should have been a basis for a trial on the merits. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Young. Mr. Donovan.
May it please the Court, John Donovan for Harris Associates. The question Your Honor raised about fiduciary duty is precisely the question that was implicated in Harris's motion for summary judgment. The statute says that an advisor is a fiduciary with respect to receipt of compensation. We don't know, other than from the text of the statute, what is meant by the word fiduciary. But you can infer it from a variety of circumstances and the way the courts have articulated and analyzed fee disputes under that language of fiduciaries. As Judge Easterbrook said, fiduciaries in ordinary contexts may negotiate to produce what the market will bear.
Except maybe Richard Grasso. Do you know what the status of proceedings about him is under New York trust law?
I don't precisely. My memory, only from reading the newspaper, Your Honor, and one copy of the...
If you think that what's going on is a fiduciary-like proceeding, it's essentially under New York nonprofit law. The rule is that $600 million a year for no apparent work may be excessive.
I think the argument, Your Honor, would be that parties, including fiduciaries, may negotiate for what the market will bear, and it is bound at some upper limit by what a court might call, for example, waste. There are lots of states, for example, whose attorney generals can look at charitable contributions or operations of charities and conclude that compensation, for example, is wasteful because it is inconsistent with the charitable purpose. But that is not this context. And there is no evidence to suggest that the fee that was charged here was so far beyond the pale of what could be negotiated at arm's length that it satisfies that standard of waste. That is how the Gartenberg Court got to the language they used, that there is a range of fees that is fair and that you violate Section 36B and violate the fiduciary duty imposed by Section 36B only if you charge a fee that is so disproportionate that it bears no relationship to the value of services rendered that it could not have been the product of arm's length bargaining. In substance, if you take the word fiduciary in 36B and marry it with the other provisions of the statute, which acknowledge the conflict of interest that the advisor has, you create, or the Congress created, a surrogate for arm's length bargaining. It created a board of directors that it required be, at that time, 40%, now 70%, independent of the advisor. It requires a process by which the trustees are obliged to request and the advisor is obliged to supply all information relevant to the decision to negotiate fees. There is no dispute in this case that the trustees in fact asked for a wealth of information, and no dispute that everything they asked for, they got. The question then is, can you conclude that if complete information was shared, if the trustees got what they wanted, and if the advisor was completely candid, that the resulting negotiation produced a fee that is, in the language of Gartenberg, so disproportionate to the value of services rendered that it could not have been the product of arm's length bargaining. Fiduciaries are characterized by candor, fair dealing, and disclosure. But nothing in this case and nothing in this record would suggest that there is a reasonable dispute about the candor of Harris, its fair dealing, and the adequacy of its disclosure. The result, the plaintiffs say, is wrong, not because of any breakdown in that substitute for arm's length bargaining, but because they say the comparison to what somebody else might be charged is somehow fair. I suggest it's a false comparison. First of all, the market here that advisors compete for is not funds to manage, but it's investors and dollars. Any individual stockholder who was dissatisfied with the fee charged by a mutual fund because he was dissatisfied of performance net of fees can pick one of 10,000 other funds to invest in. The irony, of course, is that on this record, if an investor had actually chosen to invest in virtually any other fund investing in the same asset class that had lower fees, it would have cost them, because net of fees, their performance was superior. So if you examine what is actually the economic choice that is being made, the fee is not only reasonable, it is superior to what you can get elsewhere. But all that's beside the point, because as I say, the intent of the statute is to create this surrogate for arm's length bargaining in the form of actual arm's length bargaining.
The intent of the statute? You've actually looked inside the heads of the members of Congress who were pondering this in 1940?
I have not, Your Honor. I rely exclusively upon the text of the statute that says...
So why, then, don't you say the text of the statute?
The text of the statute reveals what I consider to be the intent. The text reveals fiduciary obligation, as you said, candor, disclosure, fair dealing. It requires independent directors, and it requires disclosure for arm's length bargaining. Those three elements put together produced a result here that is within the range of reason for other fees and is not so disproportionate that it could not have been the product of arm's length bargaining. Second piece of the plaintiff's argument is that somehow they should have gotten summary judgment because of a contention that Mr. Morgenstern is not independent. The complete answer to that question is that 70% of the directors were independent, whatever you think of Mr. Morgenstern, and Mr. Morgenstern is not a defendant. He cannot be a defendant. The only defendant under Section 36B is the recipient of advisory compensation. That is not Mr. Morgenstern, and that is dispositive. If there are no more questions, that concludes my presentation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Donovan. Anything further, Mr. Young?
Judge Eastbrook, you asked about the candor of Harris with the fund and with the board, and Mr. Donovan says that there's no factual dispute about that. There is a factual dispute about those questions. There's a factual dispute about whether Harris masked its profitability by improperly attributing deferred discretionary compensation as costs rather than profits being shared with the partners of the fund. There is a dispute about whether economies of scale were masked by the accounting system employed by Harris, which allocated costs according to the size of the fund, which would, by definition, get rid of economies of scale. There are disputes about whether the board was really independent in the process. All of the evidence that goes to the first claim is also relevant under Gardenberg for that purpose. And all of this stuff is in the statement of additional facts, and their answers would be in their response to that facts. That stuff is in the record. The second argument about the wrong defendant, if Harris had bribed the board to accept an improper fee, that and then accepted a fee knowing that they had bribed the board, that would be a violation of fiduciary duty. It would violate the statute irrespective of the actual amount. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.